Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have.
Welcome to Legal Face Off on WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. Legal Eagles are here. Rich Linkoff, Tina Martini. It's been told that it's reunion week
reunion
here at Legal
week here
Face
on the
Off.
Show, right? Some old faces coming back to the show.
Yes, it's like
some surprises. Along the way, we'll talk about the Jason Van Dyke verdict, of course, which has happened recently in Chicago, and of course, the legal grab bag at the end of the show. But we lead things off with a SCOTUS conversation, one of the foremost experts in the country about the Supreme Court and the author of the book, The Supreme Court and the American Elite. He's a professor of government at the University of Texas School of Law, Professor Lucas A. Poe, Jr. Professor, welcome to WGN.
Thank you.
So, Professor, we have all just witnessed a very bruising confirmation process for Brett Kavanaugh. What have we learned so far a few days after Justice Kavanaugh has joined the bench?
I think what we've learned is Supreme Court confirmations are hearings are a disaster. We never learn anything about how the judge is going to act when on the bench. And in this case, the late disclosure of Dr. Ford's problems made it just look like a fiasco for everyone concerned.
Professor Poe, let's turn to the issues facing this court as we have a 9-justice panel right now. The court will hear cases this term on hot button issues like LGBT rights, immigration, as well as some other issues. Trump has been very vocal on some of these topics, of course. Do you think Kavanaugh will swing the court to the right and to Trump's side on these and other controversial cases that this court will hear?
I think it's inevitable that he will swing the court to the right. With Kavanaugh's confirmation, the Republicans have achieved their dream since they nominated Robert Bork in 1987 of having a solid, hard right 5-person majority on the court.
Professor, do you care to share with us a couple of the cases? I mean, there are obviously, as Rich mentioned, a number of very important and controversial issues that the court is going to be looking at with respect to the cases coming up. Do you want to maybe elaborate on a couple of those cases that they're going to be looking at in the coming weeks and months?
Well, actually, in the coming weeks and months, the court's docket is basically yawners. The justices haven't loaded up the docket with controversial cases. They're in the pipeline, especially a pair of abortion cases decided by the 8th and the 5th Circuits. But the court's docket right now is a crim law professor's dream, but not of much significance on constitutional law.
Professor, you've written extensively about the court. Sam mentioned your book. You also are one of the most avid watchers of the court and lecturers of the Supreme Court. What's it like when a new justice takes the bench, as Brett Kavanaugh did over the weekend and earlier this week? You clerked for Justice Brennan.
No, Justice Douglas.
Oh, I'm sorry, Justice Douglas. I apologize. What's it like when a new justice takes the bench?
It's interesting. Justice White said at one point in time, every time you get a new justice, it's a new court. The justices don't know how active the new justice will be in oral argument. They may not be certain of what positions he'll take. I think in the case of Justice Kavanaugh, there's a pretty good track record of how active he intends to be in oral argument based on his dozen years on the D.C. Circuit. And he has a sufficient record on the D.C. Circuit that I think in major constitutional cases, he will be a very predictable vote.
So what do you think, turning to how the other justices are going to react to him and having him alongside them hearing and deciding cases, how do you think he is going to be received by his new colleagues?
I think he'll be well received by his new colleagues. They're a very small and incredibly exclusive band of jurists. They are together hours each week. They have all the incentives in the world to get along together. And for the most part, I think they're successful in doing so.
Professor, you mentioned earlier when we talked about the confirmation process and how it was a disaster. What do you think, if any, changes are made? What changes do you think should be made, and do you think any changes will be made? Obviously, a lot depends on what happens in the midterms and eventually what happens with the presidency, of course. But let's say that Trump gets another slot before the end of his term, whether it's 4 or 8 years. Do you think if the Republicans are still in power, any of the negative effects of the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings make anyone change their ways, or is it pretty much locked in given how entrenched the parties are on their respective positions?
Totally locked in. Before the hearing started, I stated on one radio show that if Kavanaugh was proven to be a saint, the Democrats would all vote no, and if he were proven to be evil incarnate, the Republicans would all vote yes.
So what should be done? Now, let's assume you had the power to change the process. How do you think it should go? I mean, you know, it wasn't always this way, right? I mean, you've written extensively about the Supreme Court. It wasn't always as contentious as it was. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, for example, who, it's surprising now that she received the vote that she did in the Senate. Why do you think things are so different now, and how would you change things if you could change them?
Well, I think if I could do one thing, I'd rid the hearings of television. The senators all have an incentive to posture, and they're more than happy to do so. If I were trying to make another type of change, I would like to see a way to tone down the hyper-partisanship. But I simply don't believe that in the current era that's a conceivable outcome.
Do you think we'll see another vacancy? Obviously, who can predict the future, and especially with regards to health? But what do you think the chances of Trump getting a third justice on the bench are?
Unless it's health issues, there will be no further vacancy.
All right. Breaking news there, Sam. We have a clip that we can use.
Dun, 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun.
I think the season opener of Saturday Night Live, when Kate McKinnon is playing Ginsburg and she shows her September calendar and it says, "Don't die," basically captured it perfectly.
No better way to go out than that. That is Lucas A. Poe, Jr., professor of government, University of Texas School of Law, in the book, The Supreme Court and the American Elite. Thank you, sir, for your time. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
One of the most pivotal decisions we've seen in the city of Chicago was the verdict on Jason Van Dyke for the murder of Laquan McDonald. And joining us on the phones right now, Anita Alvarez, former state's attorney for Cook County and the first Hispanic woman elected to the position. She joins us now on Legal Face-Off. Good morning, Anita.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Anita, you actually charged Jason Van Dyke with first-degree murder. He was, of course, convicted last week of second-degree murder, as well as 16 counts of aggravated battery with a firearm. What are your thoughts on that verdict?
You know, my thoughts on the verdict are that I believe it's the just verdict. I believe it's the right one. I believe that, you know, based on everything we saw when we were doing this investigation on this case, the evidence that we had, you know, his role as an officer, you know, knowing, you know, when you do these police shooting cases, when you do these investigations, there's a lot that you need to know, and it's not just, you know, the law, it's what officers are trained and what their rules and regulations are, the use of force model, you have to understand that. So all that comes into play. And in Illinois, and I know I'm talking to two lawyers, but maybe the general public doesn't realize this, but in Illinois, in order to be found guilty of second-degree murder, you have to charge first. Now, that may sound a little off to, you know, a layperson, but the law is very specific. Because in order to be found guilty of second-degree murder, the prosecution has to prove every element of first degree. So in essence, the prosecution has to prove first degree murder. Then there has to be evidence introduced that it mitigates this particular first degree down to a second degree. I think it's kind of like first degree murder plus. And evidence of mitigation could be the use of force.
Well, do you think the jury got that? You know, because it almost feels like the second degree conviction was a compromise, right? We heard a lot, and we heard from some jurors that, you know, it might have been a middle ground, and I think sometimes it's viewed as a compromise. Certainly it's not, and you've done an eloquent explanation of why it's not, but how do you avoid the temptation for a juror to simply look at that as a middle ground, as a way to get a murder conviction but not up to first degree?
Well, you know, I think, could it be a compromise? Yes, I guess it could be. I've done many, many juries, and I've seen jurors come back with verdicts that, you know, maybe I don't agree with, or I scratch my head and wonder how did they get to this. But I think this case, you know, from day one when I made the charging decision, when we charged this case, you know, the internal discussions that we had amongst ourselves with the assistants who were working this investigation, and, you know, with my executive, you know, staff members, we knew that second degree was a possibility. Absolutely. And why? Because the use of force. And the question is going to become, was he justified in the use of force? And the two propositions, you know, mitigating factors for second degree would be sudden and intense passion. I don't think the facts show that. But then the question is, you know, an unreasonable belief in self-defense. And I think that's what the jurors found. And just listening to some of the jurors that were spoken to, you know, after the fact, after the verdict, because I watched that, and that's the sense that I got from their comments, that they felt it was an unreasonable belief in self-defense. And the one man even added that he felt that the situation could have been de-escalated, and, you know, and that the officer could have done more. And one of the things that, you know, in analyzing this case, you know, that always came into mind, and I think the first officers on the scene corroborated that, the question was, you know, why wasn't there a taser used? You know, why couldn't he have done something other than just beginning to fire? So I think that they did think that the jury did, you know, think this through. And I believe that that's what they found, that it was an unreasonable belief in self-defense.
So, Anita, one of the big points of this case was the discussion about the video depicting the murder and the release of that video. You had released it in late November of 2015, which was 6 months after the shooting occurred. And that video release, as we all know, sparked many days of protests. Do you think you waited too long to charge Van Dyke and to release the video?
You know, I don't. I think there's two questions there. I don't think I waited too long to charge Officer Van Dyke, and I think the release of the video that is a second component of this. First, let me talk about the investigation. You know, this occurred October 20th of 2014. That video was not given to. Obviously, we didn't have the video the day of the shooting. We found out about this you know, shortly after, maybe 2 weeks after, we got the video from IPRA, because that was the protocol. IPRA would get the videos on these cases and then send it to us. And I immediately contacted the feds, which is, you know, my counterpart over in the U.S. Attorney's Office, Zach Farden. And in my office in that first week of November was Zach Farden and the head of the FBI, the Chicago office, Bob Holly. And it was then that the three of us talked about this, because they, too, were given the video, the feds, the U.S. Attorney's Office. And we talked about, you know, where, how to handle this investigation going forward, because I think we all knew at that time, you look at that video, and it's explosive, for, you know, lack of other words to describe it. And, you know, even as a prosecutor, having, you know, investigated police shootings, having charged police officers for various crimes, you know, you look at the video and it shakes you. And I think we all, three of us, had the same reaction. And so the decision was made then that we were going to do this investigation jointly with the FBI being our investigative partner. Now, normally on these cases, it wouldn't be the FBI. It would be IPRA. And we all know that IPRA, while there were some good investigators at IPRA, let's just say, you know, I was more confident in the FBI doing this investigation. So, you know, when you're working with the feds and you're working on what I'm going to say is federal time. However, though, we did a very, very thorough investigation. And so I'll never apologize for that, because I always felt that this was a case where you wanted to get it right. And I think, you know, we saw a finding of guilty because we got it right. And that was the goal here, to make sure that we, you know, talked to every witness, uncovered, you know, turned over every stone in order to make this case the strongest possible. So, no, I don't think I took too long. Now, the release, you know, and you're lawyers, so you understand this, but we as prosecutors have other rules to guide us by, right? We all have our rules of professional conduct, but we're bound by 3.6 and 3.8, and what does that tell us as prosecutors? You're not supposed to be releasing evidence prior to trial, prior to charging, which, you know, clearly this is going to be a big piece of evidence. But I think what was going on, well, I know what was going on at the same time that we were doing our investigation, and I think, unfortunately, people kind of mixed these together, but it's like apples and oranges. The city was doing whatever the city was doing in fighting that FOIA request. The FOIA request for that video to be released went to the city, not to me, to the city. And, you know, I mean, Mayor Emanuel and Steve Patton did what they did as far as, you know, responding to that FOIA request. You know, they're the ones that voted on, you know, basically giving a settlement to a civil suit that hadn't even been filed. So I think sometimes, you know, everything gets kind of mixed together. So, you know, I believe, you know, we took the length of time on the investigation to get it right. So I'm confident in that, and I think the verdict shows that. And, you know, the video being released, you know, was something separate and apart from my investigation. So, you know, I said this way back when, and, you know, I love being a prosecutor, right? And I love my job. I do miss it. But I wasn't a very good politician, and I made decisions based on the facts, the evidence, and the law, which I did in this case. And if you look at it now, you know, kind of stepping back and looking at everything, politically, maybe that wasn't the right thing for me. However, what's more important to me was to do this investigation with integrity and to get it right.
I need a last question, about 2 minutes left here on Legal Face-Off. Many have hailed this verdict as a step forward in the community, especially with regards to police shootings. Many have said that this is the dawn of a new day in terms of accountability for police. On the other hand, I, for example, feel that this is a bit of a different case, given the amount of you know, eyes on it, given the amount of money spent on it. Not every case, of course, gets this much scrutiny. So I hesitate to look at this as a watershed moment in these kind of cases. How do you feel about this? What does the future hold for police shootings in this city and, you know, trials resulting from them, given this verdict?
You know, I think, you know, anytime you have to investigate something like this, it's difficult. But I think what's important, and it almost kind of goes back to what that juror I mentioned earlier said when he said, I thought the officer should have done more to de-escalate. I think this is a wake-up call to police training and how our officers are trained, and how they are trained to de-escalate situations like this. So I think, you know, what good could come out of this is training and improving the way officers, are trained to handle situations like this, are trained how to handle any kind of confrontation going further. We all know it's a difficult job to be a police officer, and, you know, the majority of them are great people, hardworking people that don't want to go out and do something like this. But I think it's important to note that, you know, there are changes. We can all benefit from change. And I think this does help going forward with police training and accountability. And the departments have to take note of what occurred in this case and you know, what needs to be done going forward.
She is Anita Alvarez, the former state's attorney for Cook County. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Comp Alliance is unique in the workers' compensation industry in their ability to provide comprehensive managed care services from initiation of a claim to settlement, including 24/7 nurse triage, URAC accredited medical and vocational case management. Their suite of innovative MSP compliance solutions, including fully customizable MSA programs, professional administration, and additional cost avoidance services, simplifies the claims management process. Their focus is retaining accountability, responsiveness, and quality while tailoring their services to meet your needs. For your managed care support needs, contact Comp Alliance online at compalliance.com. Again, that's compalliance.com.
And it's the way we close every show on Legal Face-Off on WGN, the legal grab bag, and we talked about reunion week. Well, guess what? Jason Klicka, Michael Heidemann, two of the most vital pieces of Legal Face-Off.
No Whiteside.
No, he's
banned.
He's MIA.
Yeah, he's
couldn't find him.
No longer in Vegas. Call him in Vegas. Hang on. Play that tune.
I heard Klicka said he wanted to know if he could swear or not, and I said, no.
That's all I do. Sam, you're
it's okay,
in
but seven... I am in Vegas, yes, which makes things interesting. But I told Rich and Tina we need the legal face-off remote. We need to do the remote here in Vegas.
Yeah, we're doing
it.
Road trip.
I'm in.
Click is in for that one. Well, first story is near and dear to my heart. It's weed becomes legal in my home country.
Which part's near and dear to your heart?
You know. We'll leave that to the imagination.
All of it.
Yeah, a lot of happy Canadians in, what, a week or so. It becomes legal across the country to use marijuana. October 17th, Canada will become the second and the largest. Who knows the first country? Sam, could you guess the only other existing country that has legalized marijuana?
No.
I think I know. Isn't it Uruguay?
If you said Uruguay and you
it's
pronounce
Uruguay.
It that way,
Uruguay.
You
it's
would be
Uruguay.
Correct.
2013.
Yeah.
Uruguay.
Well, I know that from preparing useless trivia for Richard
Yeah,
Lincoln.
Absolutely. So Canada's Cannabis Act allows people 18 years and older to buy marijuana online or in retail stores. There's stores now popping up in every province back in my home country. Most provinces have raised the minimum age to 19 to align with the drinking age. Of course, in Canada, the drinking age is 19. More
of
reason
course
to
it is.
Celebrate.
I thought it was a height requirement in Canada.
You could buy or possess 30 grams at once. That's just over an ounce for you Americans. And you could also grow 6 plants at home.
I think you're moving back to Canada, aren't you, Rich?
I'm very excited by this development. Tina Martini, as a libertarian, no? How do you feel about the legalization of marijuana in Canada, our friendly neighbor to the north, and how soon until we see it across many states? We've got 6 states now in the United States that have legalized marijuana, but what do you think?
Well, first of all, I do believe that we need to maintain friendly relations with Canada, unlike some people we know.
Yes.
Second, I do think that
what do you think of Justin Trudeau? Best looking head of government in the world, yes?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
For sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, for sure. And I do think that it's going to become legalized in a number of other states. I have never partaken, however.
Oh, are you joking? Sam, play the news break. Sound effects.
So I don't have a never personal stake in this. Never
Tina
inhaled, never done anything.
All right, so Jason Klicka, welcome back to the show. You and Mike Heiderman are the millennials on the panel here today. What do you think about this development? Good, bad, and what do you say about critics who think that the weed is a gateway to other drugs?
Good, the bad, weed. And the ugly, and the weed.
The weed, you know.
Yeah. I think it's good. I think it's good for Canada. I think it's good for industry. I mean, you're going to see, I think it's cool that you're going to see whole new markets opening up with edibles in the future.
Lots of tax revenue, right?
Lots of tax revenue. I think they said that they were taxing, what is it, $1 per gram?
Yeah.
Dollar, so that's a lot going back to Canada. But you see, even in the U.S., I read that the FDA approved its first non-synthetic cannabis derivative. So that's a step that the FDA put towards legalizing marijuana, right? So moving it from a Schedule 1 drug to a Schedule 5.
I feel like I'm talking to my father, who's a pharmacist.
Sam's sitting in Nevada, one of the states where recreational marijuana is legal. Sam, what's the vibe in, maybe vibe's not the right word. What changes have you seen in Nevada since marijuana's been legal? Because I know you're a close follower of these things.
Oh, yeah. You know, friends of friends of friends partake.
Yes.
Not that I partake ever. Like Tina, wink, wink, wink.
I'm not
but the
winking
thing is
here.
Now, no, I'm winking. Wink, wink, wink. The thing is, Rich, now everybody comes to Vegas, and this is honest. When people come in to visit me, one of the first questions they ask, where's the weed at? Right? Where's the dispensary at? And you go in, and people are so scared. And I've been to these dispensaries. What you do is you show up, you have to bring a state ID or a government ID of some form, and you walk in, and it's like you're in an ice cream parlor. And they have all these different flavors, all these different strands, rolls, you know, packages. They've got edible cakes, cookies, gummy bears. I mean, it's the Wild West out here. And people come here, and it's almost like they're scared to partake, but it is legal here. But more and more people, when they come into Vegas, those are the first questions I get. Where's the weed? Where's the dispensary? I want to check it out. It's very progressive.
Before they ask you how you're doing and saying how happy they are to see you, where's
the weed? No, they want to smoke. They want to smoke, and then they want to talk.
Yeah, and then they're a kid in a candy store.
Yeah, and remember,
right.
Weed is still illegal federally in our country, and many states, many in fact, that border Canada, like Washington, will test a driver's blood, not just for alcohol, but for marijuana impairment. So there's definitely some danger still involved. All right, moving on to our next story. We've got a trial going on in Michigan that caught our attention here on Legal Face-Off, especially in light of what happened last week with the Laquan McDonald verdict. In Rochester Hills, Michigan, on April 12th, a former firefighter named Jeffrey Ziegler had his door, he had a knock on his door from a high school student named Brennan Walker. Brennan Walker had missed the morning bus to school, didn't have his phone, wasn't sure how to get to his school, needed help finding his way, according to prosecutors, and he knocked on the door of Jeffrey Ziegler. Ziegler answered, not with helpful directions to his school, but with a shotgun blast. We've seen the video of Ziegler coming out to his porch of this young man running away in the opposite direction. And Ziegler, who's shirtless at the time, points a shotgun at Walker, aims, and fires a shotgun at him. Now he's on trial for assault with intent to murder, which in Michigan can lead to life in prison. His defense is that he was scared. He had been the victim of five previous break-ins, and that when he heard the knock, he was in fear for his life. And my favorite part of his defense, which, as you could tell, I think is nonsense, was that he only fired his shotgun because he stumbled on his porch. Now, if you look at the video, speaking of videos, we just talked about Laquan McDonald, the video being the thing. If you look at the video, he stops, He waits, he aims, and he fires at this young man running away, by the
way.
He
was full on duck hunt.
Oh, my God. He couldn't have been more intending to shoot this person.
There's no doubt that if this kid did not catch on and run, he would have been dead.
Yeah, he would have been dead. He would have been shot on the porch.
And by the way, young African-American, white person shooting. Yeah, I think this is an easy case for the jury. We'll see what happens in Michigan. But Tina, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, I mean, the context that was provided was that I think that there have been either several attempts to break into his house or that they were actual break-ins. So I think, I mean, it doesn't excuse it by any means. It sort of gives you a sense, though, as to what his thought process was. I think he was trying to send a message and was trying to kill the kid also, but trying to send a message to others to not try to break into his house, which is very, very different than self-defense. It's not the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, you have to obviously have a reasonable fear for your safety.
The guy's running away.
If he's running away, he aims and shoots. Completely ridiculous, and I think it'll be an easy case once it gets to the jury. Next story involves a frequent guest, so to speak, on Legal Face-Off, subject to a lot of discussion over the years. Harvey Weinstein, what's going on with his trial?
So his trial is going on in New York, and the prosecution told the court yesterday that they were going to drop one of the counts of the indictment, this one involving actress Lucia Evans, who's one of the three women who whose allegations actually formed the backbone of the criminal case against Weinstein. The sexual assault charges by Evans against Weinstein were thrown out by the prosecution after prosecutors claimed that in a September 12th letter to the defense, which was unsealed yesterday, that this information suggests that the encounter between Evans and Weinstein may have been consensual. So Weinstein's attorney, Benjamin Braffman, accused Evans of committing perjury when she testified to the grand jury. And according to Braffman, a fact checker with the New Yorker had provided the prosecutors with her written account about her encounter. And Weinstein's attorney claimed that the defense would subpoena the magazine. Now, the New Yorker is claiming that all the information that Weinstein's lawyers have from the magazine that claims that her account was contradicted is entirely false. And the lawyer for Weinstein is now claiming that his case has been permanently and irreparably damaged, and looks like he may try to use that as a basis to have the whole case thrown out.
Yeah, he's putting a lot of money, obviously, into the defense of his case. I mean, he's facing, I think, some serious, you know, but despite the fact that this charge was dropped, I think he's going away on these cases. We saw, Jason, we saw the highest profile accused in the Me Too movement, Bill Cosby, mm-hmm. go to jail a couple weeks ago. That was the first one to drop. What do you think the future holds for Weinstein?
Oh, I think he's going to jail, definitely. So I'm a little, it kind of went over my head. So why is this perjury? And I guess is a question more so that they're dropping this account because it weakens their case?
Well, they're claiming that she committed perjury because she was painting the incident as one of, you know, sexual assault, whereas now there seems to be contradictory evidence that the episode that she was talking about with Weinstein may have been consensual. And so, directly contradictory to her original account of it.
Mike Heideman, big picture. What do you think? What do you think goes on with Weinstein? Do you think it's a different world now that a jury has convicted someone like Bill Cosby of these crimes?
You know, we're living in a new world right now, and I feel like this is the way that things are transitioning in for a positive way. And Weinstein, I mean, he knows what he's getting himself into. It's always interesting to me, being an outsider, how these lawyers can defend somebody who, you know, is so bad and he's so, I guess, evil when it comes to these kind
of
conditions.
How could lawyers do such a thing?
How can this be?
Tina, answer for the lawyers.
Everybody needs a lawyer. Everybody needs
all lawyers.
Yes. Well, everybody needs somebody to represent their interests. So.
And everyone, similar to police officers, actually, like I said recently, is everyone, you know, likes to hate police officers and lawyers.
And
until
doctors.
You need one.
And doctors, right?
Until you
right?
really need
it's
one.
A good point.
So, but yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, a lot of this is some legal wrangling. I think at the end of the day, Weinstein will face the existing charges, and I think he's going to jail for a while. Moving on to our next case involving the NCAA. There's a bribery trial, a really important trial going on involving some basketball coaches. The allegation is that coaches were paying recruits to attend schools. Sam, you are, of course, the foremost expert on all things sports. Bring us up to speed on this case. And it's local connection as well.
Right. So Shane Hearman used to be a coach at La La Mer in Indiana, and they were like a powerhouse. They're sort of, they're not a prep school, but they're kind of built in that ilk where players go from all over the country. They go to La La Mer and play in Indiana. It's in LaPorte, Indiana, but they've had players from California. They've had players from New York. They've had players from Washington State. So this is sort of like a basketball power, but it turns out that the coach, Hearman, who is now at DePaul, has been paying players. And Brian Bowen Sr. told a jury that he received $2,000 a month. His son was a very top college basketball product, a very big prospect that was being recruited by a lot of people. And, of course, this swept the nation in the last 6 months or so when they had this sort of like this big zap where they went in all these schools. Joe Pasternak at Arizona, Lamont Evans at Oklahoma State, Mike Morrell at Texas. Where
the Riflemen.
Oh, people were just offering a lot of money. Rich, $50,000, $150,000, cars, cash, jewelry, watches. And now this guy, Brian Bowen Sr., is crying wolf in court and all these programs across the country. And we know this stuff goes on. We know it goes on. I'm not going to say it goes on everywhere, but it's a very, very popular thing because recruiting is a very dirty and shady business. But now coaches around the country are making sure they're deleting texts, they're going through their emails, and they're making sure that they can't get caught up in this as well.
Let's jump into that part because I'm interested in your opinion, Tina and Mike and Jason. The ultimate question here is whether players should be compensated, right? This has been going on for years. I mean, Ed O'Bannon really brought it to the forefront, and his, you know, his case has gone on for years. Players are, you know, getting so much money for college programs and for the NCAA. We're talking a $1 billion industry, yet they cannot get rent pay. They can't get meals. This trial is going on because some fairly small amounts of money are being exchanged. What are your thoughts on that, Tina? Should we get to a point where players should be paid for playing college basketball, football, etc.?
I don't think they should be paid. That's my own personal opinion. I think they should be focusing on school as well as the sports and knowing that if they're really good and they can make it professionally after school, then they're going to, there's plenty of time to make a lot of money, but that's my opinion.
Mike, well, thank God, because that's what we need on the show, your opinion. Imagine if you were giving someone else's opinion. That would be a weird show.
It would be a fun show.
Heidemann, what do you think? Should players get paid? I mean, is it fair to call them student athletes when really a lot of them are just there for a year? A lot of them are one and done. A lot of them are just simply there to generate income for a multi-billion dollar institution, getting little in return.
You know, I had a very successful Frisbee golf stance when I was a young college student, and I got paid zip.
Zero.
So I'm saying...
And your likeness is being used in, you know, posters thousands. And video games. And
I saw my face on a t-shirt the other day. I was like, what the heck? This is not fair.
Get out!
But I'm thinking, these students, isn't the whole college prospect and the whole process about, like, having no money and learning how to transition into the real world.
A rite of passage.
If you get $10,000 a game, this is, or for a year, that's not fair, and that's not going to teach you any lesson that you need to grow, because college is more about, you know, learning who you are and coming into yourself as a person, rather than, I need to get the latest shoe deal because I'm really good at basketball. And this is actually the first time I've heard of this story, this coming across my face. And Shane Hearman and his brother Montana, believe it or not, went to high school with me.
What?
Whoa. And might I just
the
add,
FBI is listening, Heidemann. Somehow, I believe you're implicated in this somehow.
Well, I was going to say,
and if you're listening, Heidemann is here.
Maybe the guy who taught Shane everything he knows about basketball should get a cut of this, aka me. I mean, don't quote me on that, even though it's on tape right now. But I'm saying,
actually, worse than that, we're on live. And by the way, speaking of Facebook Live, one of our frequent watchers on Legal Face Off, Michael Richards, says, nope, pay the players. These schools are exploiting their athletes at the top levels.
Oh, man. Love
Plicka, what do you think about
that? Wasn't that what scholarship's for? You know, I agree with both of you. I agree that everyone should be broke in college. right? You should.
There's something
have a
that makes
car,
you grow yeah. and makes it makes you a better
when
person.
When you were broke, but, it's because you were broke, not because you were playing, right. you know, college basketball at the highest level.
I wasn't
broke.
Getting a scholarship for playing college basketball.
No, Jason was performing intellectually at the highest levels, right, and he exactly. was broke, and that
Sam,
really
take it up. What are your thoughts? You're the guy on this. What do you think?
Well, I've talked to multiple athletic directors, and it, all right, so like the average Duke basketball player is worth $1 million. Okay, the problem is if you pay these players money, Rich, here's the issue. You can pay Duke basketball players, but then we're talking about pulling the plug on men's tennis and women's lacrosse. So if you pay, you only can pay the sports that actually bring in money. But you go down to University of Illinois, the football program makes no money. The basketball program makes a lot of money. Baseball makes nothing. I mean, there's a club team here. So you can't pay everybody, and that's the issue. If you want to pay the programs that make money, that's fine, but then you're going to lose sports for people that play lacrosse or soccer or hockey or tennis. So you'll essentially be canceling sports and ruining opportunities for people that play sports that aren't as money making.
Boom!
There goes my.
That's why you have a Sam Panayanovich.
Yeah,
let's keep moving here. We've got a story involving someone being compelled to use face recognition in a case against them. Tina, what's going on?
Yeah, so a year ago, we had talked on Legal Face Off about the launch of the iPhone X, which implemented the facial recognition capability on the iPhone. And we had talked about the potential consequences of these capabilities, particularly as it relates to law enforcement. So Forbes just reported last week about the first known case where law enforcement has actually compelled someone to unlock their phone using the Apple Face ID. So back in August, the FBI searched the home of Grant Mikulski, who is from Columbus, Ohio, and was accused of receiving and possessing child pornography. He was asked by the FBI agent to unlock his phone for the authorities, at which point the FBI agent was able to search his phone, including his text messages, photos, and other information. So unlocking one's phone with their face is different than using passcodes, which have historically been protected under the Fifth Amendment on the basis that knowledge of the passcode could be considered as leading to self-incrimination. But it's different than biometric information, which is not considered to be protectable under the Fifth Amendment. So it's going to be interesting to see how this this moves forward. I think in this case, because we were dealing with something as insidious as child pornography, that you know, we've seen other instances where the traditional scope of what is permitted with respect to search warrants has been a little bit different with something like child pornography because of how terrible that crime is. But I don't know what you guys think of this. I think it's very interesting. I think that's why this was permitted here.
Somehow this reminds me of one of my favorite movies, Face Off.
Oh yeah, I remember that. That was a great movie.
In order to stop him, I must become him.
That's my
dumb guy answer to your very thoughtful legal analysis of that case. Clicka, what do you think of this? Should suspects be compelled to use their use technology like this?
Like Tina said, I think because this is such a, you know, it's a very clearly awful and disgusting crime, that everyone's going to say yes, right? But then you think about it from a standpoint of privacy, and it gets a little murky. I like how they say traditionally using a person's face as evidence or to obtain evidence would be considered lawful. So traditionally, is it like, ladies and gentlemen, just look at him.
Give me that. Give me that face.
Could he have done it?
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to Face Off, though. That's a cool discussion.
John Travolta.
Nick Cage.
Yeah. The worst part about that was at the end they switched back.
Yeah.
And it's like, I thought you were the bad guy. I can't see him.
You just ruined
way.
It for everybody.
Classic spoiler
Cage, right there. That was classic Cage. Cage has moved on to some lesser roles now, but. You know, you got to love Nick Cage. He works about 15 times a year, pounding up movies.
Oh, yeah.
Heidemann, a Cage fan?
Absolutely.
Cage or Travolta?
I'm going to go Cage all the way because of his passion in movies, and I think that Con Air.
Who could do a good Cage impersonation? Anyone?
I bet you can.
I have one. I'm going to hold that. So Con Air. I'm a big Con Air guy,
Con Air. I could do a Cage impersonation.
Oh, let's hear it. Go.
The bees! Thank you very, very much.
That's nice. Well, Con Air, you would have to say, put down the bunny. You know, it's a terrible. Sam, are you in on Cage?
Nah.
No? Travolta? More of a Travolta guy? I'm early Travolta?
Early Travolta, not Cage. Cage drives me nuts.
Really?
Oh, come on, Sammy.
Love Cage. All right, let's keep moving. We're going to come back to Nick Cage legal stories shortly. There's a lot of those, actually. But we've got our friends at the Fyre Fest, not to be confused with the Fry Test. It looks like a Fry Fest, but it's actually the Fyre Fest, a story we've covered over the years here on Legal Face-Off.
Yes.
Right?
Yes,
now there's news. What's the news, Tina Martini?
So Billy McFarland, the creator of the Fyre Festival, not to be confused with the Fry
it's
Festival.
It's spelled weirdly. That's why it's hard to...
Yes. He tried to make it exotic by changing the spelling of the word fire. He was sentenced yesterday to 6 years in prison after he defrauded investors of $26 million in connection with the 2017 Fyre Festival. And he also, after he was arrested in connection with the scam, he happened to sell over $100,000 in fraudulent tickets.
Mm.
So he had staged these private events that were supposed to be really high end between 2013 and 2017. And exaggerated to a total of 80 investors about what this festival was going
One
to draw.
One of which
draw.
Was Jason Whiteside, former
Is that why he
co-host?
Disappeared?
Yes.
So now the truth comes out yes. as to why I replaced him. Now it all makes
Correct.
Sense.
Go ahead.
So he apparently then took these funds and diverted $13 million of these wow. funds into his private financial accounts and lived quite the lifestyle of luxury.
Favorite part of the story, Tina? Is Judge Naomi Rice Buchwald called him a serial fraudster.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Fraudster. Wasn't sure that was a word before I read that story.
It is. Not He's a serial fraudster.
Friendster.
And that he's certainly not a well-intentioned young man like
Correct.
his counsel tried to paint him out to be.
Guys, you go to these festivals that all the mm-hmm. all the kids seem to like nowadays.
I'm still waiting for my refund.
You, yeah. you millennials, you.
Yeah, you kids today.
$1,200 for Blink-182.
Yeah, that's
Would you pay
$1,200? That's the biggest crime right there, right?
That's like the fraudster.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think
Sam?
I'll pay $100,000.
You remember the story, Sam?
Oh, yeah, Fyre Fest. Yeah, wasn't that where there was, like, garbage everywhere and, like, nobody
well,
paid for anything?
High-end food. It was like a cheese sandwich and...
Yeah.
Well, yeah,
and
a leaky tent. It was supposed to be high-end accommodations, and they were staying in leaky white tents
All right,
instead.
Here's what I'm going to do. Give me a sound effect, a backup on this one, Sam. I'm officially taking the story off Legal Face-Off forever. You will never hear from the Fyre Festival again. Let's put this one to bed forever, yeah? Goodbye, Fyre Festival.
To the shredder.
Finally, favorite story of the day. Kanye, need I say more? Tina, go.
So yesterday afternoon.
I had this, by the way, on the rundown, I had this as Kanye berserking.
So,
which I think is a word, right?
Yeah, it is. That is definitely a word.
Go ahead.
So Kanye spent a half hour yesterday with Donald Trump in the Oval Office, along with a number of White House aides, reporters, and NFL star Jim Brown. So in what has been characterized as a rant, in a very wild and rambling fashion, with a mixture of free association metaphors and slogans, while he was wearing his red Trump hat, Make America Great Again, he covered many topics. And it makes its way on Legal Face-Off because he happened to cover the 13th Amendment, among other things.
Of course he did.
So he covered prison reform.
There's no more thoughtful analyst of the Constitution than our friend Yeezy, but go ahead.
So he covered prison reform, mental health, presidential airplanes, and racism, claiming that with respect to the 13th Amendment, that unpaid prison labor is a trapdoor into slavery. He also talked about how successful he is and how he had been misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder, and in fact, what it really was major sleep deprivation.
Who would have ever thought that Trump would be the most sane part of any Oval Office tirade? That's what I was thinking when I watched this. Guys, do you see it?
You
have to watch it and then read the transcript separately to really absorb it. It's amazing stuff.
It's like he went in there with a few key points and then he just let himself just go wild. It's like any kind of content creation or a quick meeting with your boss when you have like 1,000 ideas, but you only have 5 minutes to say it, and so it just comes out rambling, and you're just like trying
banging
to,
on the desk. That's JFK's desk, by the way, and you're banging on it.
There, he said the F word to the president at that time too. And what kind of a world do we live in where Kanye West is here making the decisions and the entire news story? I mean, we have a hurricane going on in Florida, but the Kanye going crazy in front of the president.
It's the modern Elvis meets Nixon, right? Click it. It's the modern day version of Elvis and Nixon.
I like his Superman comments. Yeah. We all know what he's going to be for Halloween now.
Yeah. And the, and when he showed Jared, who I think he called Jerry, by the way, Jared Kushner, I'm pretty sure he called him Jerry. And he showed him the picture of his plane.
The gift.
Like, check this out.
He said, I have a gift.
Yeah. And Jared Kushner approached it with all the enthusiasm that he always does. He was like, huh. Interesting.
Well, and they hugged it out, though. So as
well,
offensive as
Kanye. Well, there was a weird side hug. It was like Trump was seated and like Kanye was all over him.
And then he said, I love
that guy.
I love you.
I love you.
Yeah. Sam, what do you make of ex-Cleveland Brown great Jim Brown, who it was like a hostage video. Jim Brown was just sitting there with his cane. Sam, did you see
it? It was pretty awkward. Yeah, it was pretty awkward. But yeah, I have nothing against Jim Brown. I'm a big Jim Brown fan. Yeah. I want to actually take it back to Kanye. Did anybody else catch my man's password when he opened up the phone? God. There was a video.
It was the same.
Did you see what his password is?
Wow.
0000000000.
What's on his phone is worth maybe $6 billion, and that's his password.
Bro, you got to change that because you're going to get your iCloud hacked. That's 0000000 is not a good password.
Imagine the Kim Kardashian pictures that are now out there even more because of that password violation.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I'd like to think it's just a lot of random photos of just those planes that he has. Just like he's a totally different person than we ever thought he was. No pictures of his kids or anything like that.
Just all
planes and Donald
gifts
Trump.
Of
East,
planes.
North, West.
Yeah. Amazing stuff. Final comments from our guests. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
This was a total honor, Rich. Thanks for having us.
How many years have you guys been running?
We're now on Legal Face-Off's fifth year.
Well, I'm a year and a half into the show.
Yeah.
That's because Whiteside disappeared into Vegas somewhere.
We're not quite sure. Still there's an investigation that's underway to try to find
I've never seen him since.
He's no on Con Air right now.
Even when he was here, he was never really seen. Let's get back. We've got a few minutes. Let's get back to Nick Cage movies. Tino Martini, favorite Nick Cage movie? Come on.
What is it? The Moonstruck. I love Moonstruck.
Moonstruck. Snap out of it.
Snap out of it.
Look at what you got. It can't be one that we've already mentioned.
All the National Treasure.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Nick Cage is our National Treasure.
Ooh, well said. Sam, what do you got for Nick Cage movies? Even though you said you weren't a big Nick Cage guy.
Gone in 60 Seconds.
Ooh. Not bad with a young Angelina Jolie with cornrows.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that. Wow. Blast from the past.
Heidemann, favorite. Go.
I already said Con Air, but actually, since the new age of Nick Cage, I really liked his performance in the movie Kick-Ass.
Kick-Ass.
He gets lit on fire at the end.
You know that Dave Chappelle was in Con Air. Remember a young Dave Chappelle?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he started that one other guy on fire in the plane or in the bus.
Love Con Air.
What's your favorite one?
Well, I'm going to go way back and give you one that you didn't know that Nick Cage was in and tell you Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Oh, yeah.
A very young Nick Coppola.
Yeah, I was going to say. I was going to say, you ruined my question for everybody to see what the millennials know about Nick Cage.
I believe we were promised a Nick Cage impression.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I did it already. You didn't hear it with the bunny? I got to really get my head inside the Nick Cage impersonation. It's going to take some minutes.
Okay, what about Casey Kasem?
Well, you know I can do Casey Kasem at any time. Coming at you for the Nick Cage Film Festival. We're not going to stop till we get to the top. Keep your feet on the ground and keep reaching with the stars. For Legal Face-Off, I'm Rich Lenkov. Tina Martini, take us out.
What do you mean, take us out?
Oh, man. You blew it. Sam, all you, buddy.
What a finish. Yeah, what an exclamation point. Thanks to Jason and Michael, for Rich and Tina, and big thanks as always to Ben Anderson. We'll talk to you next time on Legal Face-Off.
Big goodbye to our friends on Facebook Live.
Bye, Facebook Live.
Ooh. Thanks
See
for
you guys
tuning
later.
In.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkov. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat.